Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to Year in Review. This is the day we talk about the management of lymphomas, Hodgkin and non-Hodgkin lymphomas. We have a great faculty today, Dr. Chris Flowers from MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston, and Dr. Laurie Sen from the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. As always, if you have any questions or cases you'd like to run by us, just type them into the chat room. We'll talk about as many of these as we have time. We always put out a quick one-minute pre- and post-meeting survey. If you could take that, you'll get a lot more out of this meeting today. We know a lot of people like our audio programs and end up listening to our webinars. If you're into audio programs and podcasts, check out our Oncology Today series, including a program we did with Dr. Ansel on Hodgkin lymphoma. We do webinars all the time. Tomorrow we're doing a really interesting one, focusing on adverse events with BTK inhibitors in oncology. And then next week we'll be doing a program in breast cancer, looking at ovarian suppression ablation in those patients, the consequences thereof. The week after, we got a big week. We're heading out to the GU Cancer Symposium. We're doing three satellites there. So if you're in the San Francisco area, drop one in. If you're not, check it out online. It'll be going on Pacific time, so a little bit later for Eastern time people. But Wednesday night, we've got a great program on renal cell cancer, Thursday, prostate cancer, Friday, bladder cancer. And then just to make the week complete, we're then heading over to North Carolina, Charlotte, North Carolina, to do a day-long program on Saturday, February 18th, with the North and South Carolina Oncology Associations. We're going to be covering about 20 different tumor types. We have about 14 investigators. And again, for those of you in the North Carolina area, stop on in. Others will be putting it out online on that Saturday. But today we're here to talk about lymphomas and kind of what happened over the past year, which is in all parts of oncology a lot. I met with both of our faculty in the last couple weeks, and we recorded a presentation, so one by Dr. Flowers on diffuse large B-cell in Hodgkin, and another one by Dr. Sen on FL and mantle cell lymphoma. I really get a lot out of this program tonight. If you go back and check out those presentations, they're in the chat room if you want to download them, and we're also going to be send them out by email. On these presentations, our faculty goes through in pretty much detail a whole bunch of papers and presentations over the past year. It's really comprehensive, at least in our mind, in terms of some of the key things that people are talking about. Today, we're going to really try to take it to the next level in terms of some of the important clinical and research implications of these data sets. But there is a lot going on, obviously, in this field. We're going to start out. I just want to get the faculty's thoughts about a recent development, actually, since I met with them in the last week. And then we'll dive into the slides and talk about management of lymphoma. But Chris, this wasn't exactly a surprise, but it certainly was welcome. We've been talking about pirtobrutinib and all the excitement, not just in mantle cell, which is where it was approved last week, but also in CLL. We'll see when that happens. But Chris, we'll talk about this later when we get to the mantle cell section, but I just thought it was such an epic, really, moment, I think, in hematologic oncology to see this agent approved. Any thoughts about sort of what the initial reaction is going to be? Of course, research-wise, this drug is being studied in a lot of trials, but in mantle cell and even CLL, even though it's not approved, what the impact of having this drug available is going to be, Chris?
Yeah, really pleased to see this approval come forward. So pirtobrutinib, as you know, is a non-covalently bound BTK inhibitor, the first of that kind to be approved in mantle cell lymphoma. Michael Wong from our place was very involved and led that trial. And really important to see this come forward in mantle cell for patients with relapsed and refractory disease. And we've also seen that this is an agent that is active even in settings where the patients have failed another BTK inhibitor. And looking forward to see how it gets used in practice and how it moves forward in clinical trials.
So, Laurie, when we get to mantle cell, we'll talk about, as you covered in your talk, particularly the two big upfront papers that brought BTK inhibitors to the first-line setting and whether that's going to take hold. But I'm curious what you're going to be thinking about where pirtobrutinib is going to fit in these patients at this point. Are you going to be thinking about it after a BTK inhibitor or maybe waiting a little longer? And also, I'm curious what your experience has been with tolerability, Lori.
So, you know, right now for mantle cell lymphoma, we've got two really reasonable lines of therapy with kind of chemoimmunotherapy approaches still in the upfront setting and then BTK inhibitor second line. Once patients start to fail that BTK inhibitor second line, you know, your choice is potentially to go to CAR T-cell therapy, of course, and then there's novel agents being evaluated, but they run into really limited options with higher toxicity. So I think this is super attractive that, you know, we have the opportunity with pirtobrutinib to potentially extend the benefit of a BTK inhibitor for a patient who is potentially showing resistance. So I can see it being used right where it's approved in the third line setting to see if we can extend that, you know, BTK benefit. Obviously, there are trials going on in earlier lines of settings, and I think those are really important. But the important thing is that, you know, BTK inhibition has been really a game-changing treatment for mantle cell, and pirtobrutinib may offer the ability to extend the benefit in patients who are otherwise becoming resistant. So I think in the short term, that's where it'll be used, where it's approved. But, you know, intriguing to see whether or not it can replace some of the BTK inhibitors we're using, and those trials we'll need to see. But it is a well-tolerated BTK inhibitor and, you know, with a toxicity profile that looks very favorable even compared to other BTK inhibitors.
Yeah, we're doing a whole symposium tomorrow night just on toxicity issues that everybody's familiar with. It, you know, fortunately doesn't end up with people having therapy stop very often, but certainly quality life-wise, not rare to have issues. Chris, we're not talking about CLL, but I've got to ask you where you know, I don't know how it's going to happen, whether, you know, hopefully there'll be an approval, but, you know, if you have a patient who's already resistant to a non-covalent BTK and venetoclax and anti-CD20, I mean, it kind of seems like this would be the best choice. Would you like to use it there?
Yeah, it looks to be quite active in that setting, both in CLL and in mantle cell. We're looking forward to seeing kind of how regulatory bodies view this in CLL, but hopefully will be an option for docs in the community to use in the future.
So somebody in the chat room is already asking us about triplet therapy in mantle cell. You got to wait till the end. We put that at the end just to make you wait to hear what they have to say about it, because I'm real curious. Anyhow, let's dive into the data sets that we talked about in these talks. Here are the ones that Chris covered related to diffuse large B cell. I'm going to show some of the slides, but really, I really want to focus on clinical and research implications. A lot of this obviously relates to recurrent disease, and that's, we'll talk a lot about that. But of course, the first thing we're going to talk about is the Polarix trial using polatuzumab vedotin and the antibody drug conjugate in the upfront setting. And Chris presented that. I think everybody's familiar with that. The fact there was a benefit, you know, hazard rate not all that phenomenal, you know, around the 0.75 range, but still, you know, theoretically one out of four relapses observed. And Laurie, you know, it looks so far like, and I think this kind of, you know, syncs up with what we've seen clinically, what you've seen. It looks so far like the toxicity, particular neurotoxicity, peripheral nerve toxicity, not much different, if at all. There was some data Chris reviewed from ASCO on that. What's your take, first of all, about this toxicity, Laurie? And would you like to be able to use it, and which patients?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think it's fair to say that head-to-head, the toxicity profiles were not that different. So when you start talking about, you know, changing one standard of care to the next, you know, one of the first questions is this going to be a step up in toxicity, and what's the risk-benefit ratio? Well, here, the way the trial was designed, of course, the vincristine was omitted to make way for the polatuzumab, so that led to a very comparable regimen in terms of neurotoxicity, and I'd say broadly for the other toxicities as well. So the primary endpoint of this trial was progression-free survival. We now saw at ASH this year the three-year data presented, and the curves are pretty much identical, where that split we saw about an absolute improvement of about 6.5% remained steady over time. Still no overall survival benefit, but this is still early data, and these patients do go on and get second and third line therapies that can keep them going. So I think this is compelling data. You know, my goal is to try and cure the most patients I can in the upfront setting. And you know, here we see that the polatuzumab does contribute to a significantly higher proportion of patients that are remaining progression-free.
So, Chris, any comments? And also in your talk, you reviewed some new data looking at ctDNA. You know, finally, it got me into the heme. You know, we've been talking about solid tumors nonstop. They never, every time we talk, that's this comes up, particularly now GI cancers in particular. But we saw some data now here looking at ctDNA clearance. Any thoughts on that or any comments related to what Laurie just said?
Yeah, so two quick comments. So first, I completely agree with all the points that Dr. Sen just made. And perhaps the one new piece of data that's out since I gave my talk last week is that NCCN has now weighed in on the Polarix data. And in the recent NCCN guidelines, they're now recommending that as a category one for the IPI two through five patients who are eligible. So essentially, all patients who are eligible for this study, they're recommending it as a category one. In terms of the ctDNA data, these were data that were presented this last year looking at ctDNA clearance. And this essentially shows here, this is now combining both arms of the trial, both the R-CHOP arm and the Pola-R-CHIP arm. But you can see shown in the blue curves, those patients who cleared their ctDNA at cycle two, day one, had markedly better progression-free survival and overall survival with the hazard ratios that are shown there. What we'll see at future meetings are what do the end of treatment ctDNA look like. And so ctDNA clearance at the end of treatment and whether the difference is there, how do those play out in terms of PFS and OS? So coming at a future meeting for you.
So, Laurie, another issue about this, and incidentally in the chat room, Hassan says, what do you think you'd see if you add a bispecific like glofitamab to R-CHOP compared to Polarix? So you might want to comment on that and if that's even being looked at. But also the issue of whether everybody should be offered that. It looked like the benefit was mainly in patients with the ABC subtypes. When we asked people what they want to do, some people only want to give it to those patients. So any thoughts about adding a bispecific to R-CHOP up front? And any thought about subsets of diffuse large B-cell and whether or not you want to use this strategy in everybody?
Well, so given the benefit we've seen of bispecifics in the relapsed refractory setting as monotherapy, there's been a huge enthusiasm to try and move them up front. So far, we've seen safety data with combining them with R-CHOP, for example, and what we can tell from those safety trials is that it does appear feasible and safe, but it's really hard to get a signal of benefit because R-CHOP is so good. So it's going to take randomized data for us to know how that's going to impact. We still don't know whether or not, you know, bispecifics will work as well as they do as monotherapy when we combine them with chemoimmunotherapy and you're simultaneously, you know, hurting the immune system and the T cells. So it is an open question, but those trials are going to be done. The first that I'm aware of is epcoritamab R-CHOP versus R-CHOP. That trial is planned and underway shortly. I don't think we've seen the full design of the glofitamab study being publicly announced yet, but I anticipate there'll be a trial with glofitamab as well. So, you know, you need to stay tuned with that. Right now, it would not be considered advisable as standard of care. In terms of your question about, you know, would you use Pola-R-CHOP differentially based on cell of origin, Pola targets CD79B, and CD79B is universally present regardless of cell of origin. So it's a bit of a surprise when we saw the forest plots presented in the Polarix trial that there did seem to be a differential benefit with more benefit for the ABC subtype. That's kind of hard to biologically understand. So I think we need to be careful that we're not being fooled somehow by this, you know, univariate comparison, and there may be other factors at play that travel with ABC cell of origin that might be giving that hint of excess benefit. But nonetheless, you know, I think you can't argue that there was that differential shown. Right now, you know, as I said, without kind of a good biological excuse for why that would be the case, and the fact that, you know, there may be other factors at play, I wouldn't suggest using that information to, you know, preferentially select patients. It wasn't powered for definitive conclusions, but I think nonetheless, it is definitely an ongoing topic for debate.
You could say, well, there's no downside, but there's always the financial downside. I don't think you can ignore that. And I think also, once you start messing with R-CHOP, it kind of reminds me of using IV methotrexate for CNS prophylaxis. You don't want to, you got a potentially curative therapy. You don't want to lose, you know, get toxicity that's going to have you hold the R-CHOP. So I guess that'll be important to look at carefully. Let's talk a little bit about really where I get a lot of questions, Chris. Which is a relapse disease, because now we have so many options with more coming on board with the bispecifics, which I imagine is going to be pretty soon. We've just seen the approval in follicular. So let's talk. You updated us on a number of these strategies being used right now in the relapse setting, and particularly and including patients who are maybe not going to be eligible for transplant. Tafa-Len seems like it has some very interesting data. I hear a lot of oncologists talking about using it and having good experience in terms of tolerability. Anything you want to say about what we've learned over the last year about this regimen and what your own experience is with it?
Yeah, I will say that Tafa-Len has looked to be quite a tolerable regimen. Really, the tafasitamab, the CD19-directed antibody, adds relatively little in terms of toxicity to the lenalidomide, with the major toxicity seen in that combination regimen predominantly being cytopenias that come from the lenalidomide. In the Tafa-Len pivotal trial, the vast majority of those patients were treated in second-line therapy. So again, these are patients that who were relapsed and refractory with diffuse large B-cell lymphoma and viewed in the eyes of the investigator not to be transplant-eligible candidates. And so this is that particular population. This study shown here, the ReMIND2 study, was another attempt to be able to take that phase two single arm study and then compare it to a matched cohort of patients. And I think one of the things that you see that's well displayed here is the number of thousands of patients they had that were treated with systemic therapy or treated with bendamustine rituximab or treated with R-GemOx in the relapse setting that started out as their database of observational patients and then were narrowed down to patients in the 70s to be able to match. And so a relatively highly selected match cohort. But when you do match those two groups, you can see with the curves to the right that the Tafa-Len group shown in the light green fared more favorably than those patients who were treated with standard systemic therapies.
Lori, any comments on this? I mean, it kind of looks like there's somewhat of a plateau on there. And if, you know, one of these bispecifics gets approved, do you think would you be wanting to use it before or after Tafa-Len?
You know, so we've seen a lot of approvals in relapse refractory DLBCL, you know, namely Pola-BR. We saw Tafa-Len. We've seen loncastuximab, we've seen selinexor, and now we're going to have bispecifics. And the reality is none of them have been compared head-to-head against each other. So I think we do need to look at the data separately and judge an individual patient's kind of the risk-benefit ratio for that patient. I think Tafa-Len, you know, we saw some real-world data at ASH this year, again, suggesting what many of us suspected, that is, it seems to be better, as Chris noted, in patients who receive it second line and those patients who are more relapsed than primary refractory. So, you know, if we're going to balance out and try and optimize therapy, I'm more likely to choose Tafa-Len for that kind of patient, whereas if we look at the trials of the bispecifics that are showing quite you know, positive benefit, many of those trials are weighted for these primary refractory, you know, early relapsing patients. So I think that the bispecifics will have more value in that population. And for that population, I would definitely bump it up ahead of treatment like Tafa-Len.
So Lonca-T is another agent and the antibody drug conjugate and Chris, that Laurie just referred to. You reviewed some of the data that came out over the past year with Lonca-T. Can you talk a little bit about that, but also your experience with it? You know, I feel like we talk about antibody drug conjugates all the time now in oncology, so many different cancers. You see all kinds of interesting tolerability, toxicity issues. Any comments on your experience with this agent?
Yeah, so loncastuximab tesirine, as you mentioned, is a CD19-directed antibody drug conjugate. These data were published at the tail end of 2021 by Paolo Caimi describing the LOTIS-2 clinical trial. Again, there was a single-arm trial, and you can see the data here in terms of the complete response rate, which was in a little bit less than 25% patients, and a median progression-free survival in that patient population of 5 months. There also were some additional data that came out that were presented last year by Juan Alderuccio, looking at this in a particular subset, the high-grade B-cell subgroup, suggesting that in a small number of patients, that there were patients that had very durable responses. I think one of the challenges that we've seen with this agent is trying to really figure out where to sequence it, given all the options that we have for patients. We just talked a little bit about tafasitamab, lenalidomide, so a CD19-directed therapy, CAR T-cell that we'll talk about perhaps a little bit as another CD19-directed therapy, and then this as a CD19-directed antibody-drug conjugate, and then other agents like other combinations like Polo-BR and chemoimmunotherapy combinations. And so it becomes a little bit challenging knowing which patient population this is ideal for.
So, Laurie, a couple questions in the chat room about using anti-CD19 strategies, which we just talked about two of them prior to CAR-T. Do we have any data on it? And if we assume, I haven't seen a lot of it on there. Like, do you try to avoid that or not worry about it?
You know, I do worry about it a little bit personally. So we know that, you know, following CD19-directed CAR T-cell therapy, quite often we've seen downregulation of CD19, and that's been well demonstrated in even up to a third of patients, if not more. The data on the other salvage therapies like Lonca-T and tafasitamab, I think, is less clear. We don't seem to get that same signal, but I still think it's still small numbers and small data at this point. So if I had a different option, I probably would avoid an anti-CD19 therapy immediately prior to CAR-T, but it really comes down to options, and sometimes you need to bridge a patient, and if they're not responding to other things, you know, I probably wouldn't hesitate to bring them in.
So speaking of CAR-T, Chris, you reviewed what we learned this year. Of course, last year's ASH was a monster for CAR-T, all the second-line trials. What an incredible set of data to sift through, and we've been able to look at it this past year. This is the ZUMA-7 study that was first presented there. Can you talk about where we are today with CAR-T in general, and in what situations, Chris, you're using it second-line?
Yeah, so CAR-T is very clearly moved into the second-line therapy for patients with diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. I just rotated off the CAR-T service a couple of days ago this week and had probably at least a half dozen patients that we treated in the second line over that course of the week with CAR-T therapy. There was really a very nice review that came out in Blood from Dr. Sen and my colleague Jason Weston, describing kind of how CAR-T should be utilized in the second line therapy. And so for those patients who have relapsed early, so within 12 months, or a primary refractory disease, we know from this randomized trial, the ZUMA-7 trial, and another trial looking at lysocabtagene, the transform trial that you're showing here, that CAR-T in both of those trials was superior to the standard of care approach of giving salvage chemoimmunotherapy and then following that by autologous stem cell transplant for those patients who are responders to therapy. The trial designs for both of these trials, it kind of stands to reason that CAR-T might outperform the standard of care approach, because we're taking patients who are refractory to chemoimmunotherapy or had early relapse, so relapse within 12 months, which also is probably a refractory population. And then the hope there with standard of care is that they failed one form of chemoimmunotherapy, and then with another form of chemoimmunotherapy that you're going to get a response. We know from prior studies of auto transplant in that setting that that is not the place where auto transplant really performs very well. And in fact, we saw that borne out in this trial where CAR T performed quite a bit better than auto transplant in exactly this situation.
So I keep flashing on making rounds with you in the CAR T service there, seeing nine people with diffuse. That would be incredible. We got to go make rounds with you sometimes. Laurie, any comments about this past year since we had that big explosion at ASH last year with these second line trials? And of course, the one negative trial also that, you know, kind of pushed that back. Any comments?
Yeah, so I think, you know, as Chris said, that in this patient population, most of them don't get a good benefit to salvage chemoimmunotherapy and can't go on to transplant. The one open-ended question that these trials left behind is, what happens to this patient who does get a really good response to salvage? So some of these patients need to go on to bridging salvage. They get our ICE and suddenly, you know, they've had a good response. And then people are left wondering, do I still go to CAR T at this point? Do I take this person to transplant? I'm hearing many of my colleagues saying that they're still going to transplant in that group of patients if they see a really robust response to salvage that was given, you know, in the context of bridging. There was just one piece of data I saw at ASH this year that I thought was very intriguing, and this was a retrospective look at patients who achieved a complete response to R-ICE who had been primary refractory or early relapsing. And if they had a complete response to R-ICE salvage, they actually did quite well with transplant, even though they would have been defined in this high-risk group that these trials explored. So I think that's the one population where there is still room for discussion. But, you know, as an intent-to-treat population, clearly CAR T-cell therapy has become the preferred next line of treatment.
Any follow-up in terms of T-cell, Chris, in terms of why the trial wasn't positive as opposed to the other two? Was that markedly positive?
Yeah, there are a number of reasons that are involved there. A few of those include the issue with manufacturing, where the time to infusion of CAR T was much longer in that trial than it was in the other two. And other issues included that the trial allowed a crossover between the two arms of the study, and there were patients that crossed over to CAR T in those arms of the study. And then other questions remain about the efficacy of that product in this particular setting, but clearly showed a different result than the other two trials did.
So one more diffuse large B-cell question, and then we're going to, we'll get into a little bispecifics too. Selinexor, Laurie, of course, we've been talking about this in our myeloma programs. It's been utilized for a while. Interesting to see how they've dealt with trying to decrease the toxicity. Also an issue with a relapse diffuse large B-cell. Any comments with it? I don't know if it's even approved in Canada. Any thoughts about it, Laurie?
It's not approved here, so you know, I don't have a lot of personal experience with it. You know, I am all for more options in patients with relapse refractory DLBCL because we know that these patients can and do run out of options still. But I guess weighting it against the other options that we have available, it's probably not high on my list of priorities to consider using in relapsed refractory DLBCL. We know that even this trial, again, is a single-arm trial. Many of the patients in my mind were a little select, so there was a big washout window between their last therapy and when they were able to be enrolled. So I think that patients with very rapid biologically progressive disease weren't enrolled on this SADAL study. And overall, it had modest benefit, very few patients achieving complete response. So it's an oral agent, it's convenient, but I think weighing up against our other options probably is not as effective.
But, you know, there are people who go through all those other options, and I guess it's nice to have another option there. Chris, any comments on your experience with it. The myeloma people tell us you have to watch these people carefully, use preemptive GI medications. If you do that, that, you know, it can be tolerable. What's your experience?
Yeah, I treated some of the patients on this saddle trial, and I think, you know, it is an agent that, at least in the doses that we were giving it in diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, has been difficult to tolerate. I think some of the challenges or the fatigue that patients experience is quite profound. And then another side effect is kind of the asthenia or malaise that people just feel bad all over while they're taking in the drug. And the fact that it's an oral agent does make it very convenient to give. I don't know if you have the slide that I showed in my other presentation, but showed that there actually was a dosing cohort in diffuse large B-cell lymphoma that was a higher dose, and that higher dose was difficult to tolerate and actually hasn't even been analyzed in terms of its efficacy because it was so difficult to tolerate. In the myeloma community, they found ways to give it in lower doses and to give schedules that may be easier to tolerate. We haven't really explored that as well in lymphoma, and I think the real question remains, if we do change the dosing in lymphoma to make it more tolerable, will we still see the limited efficacy that Laurie described?
So, Laurie, bispecifics in diffuse large B-cell, we have several. From my point of view, you know, sort of 30,000 feet, it kind of looks hard at this point for me to differentiate them. And so they all have very significant response rates. So glofitamab, you know, 52% response rate with a high CR rate. The safety profile, I think we can talk about, but I think we know what that is in terms, particularly CRS. Also, epcoritamab is another agent with a high response rate, 63%. And then odronextamab, another bispecific, again, high response rates, relatively tolerable. Laurie, what's your global take on efficacy, tolerability, and where you think this is going to fit in?
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I think I'm as enthusiastic as many people who've been watching this data evolve over time. So many of these trials, if you look at the patient inclusion criteria, have included very high-risk patients that we would say would be very hard to treat with our standard of care treatments. These are patients that would not have had curative options at this point when they were enrolled, many of them. And you can see here that, you know, not only do we see relatively high response rates and CR rates, but some of these are quite durable. The data is still very early in all the trials. We still like to see longer follow-up. We don't know if these are going to be curable and if this will be a curable therapy in any patients. But, you know, clearly many patients have been able to achieve durable benefit with, you know, I think it's too early to say a plateau on the curve, but really a nice flattening out where those patients who respond, respond early and maintain that response quite well. You know, in my experience, these are very well tolerated drugs. So of course we've got the new toxicity that, you know, clinicians will need to deal with, and maybe not so new. We saw it with CAR T cell therapy as being cytokine release syndrome, which is definitely going to be a toxicity that people will need to learn how to manage as these bispecifics roll out for lymphoma. But aside from the requirement for step-up dosing in cycle one and the close monitoring and management for CRS, I'd say that clinically the patients tolerate bispecifics very well with very few side effects. So I think the quality of life in patients on bispecifics is excellent. Cytopenias, you know, can occur, but again, that's lesser than generally what we see with chemotherapy-based approaches. So I think there's going to be a huge benefit to these agents with a really relatively favorable risk profile.
And we'll talk about bispecifics. Now the one's approved, mosunetuzumab and follicular lymphoma. We'll talk about it with mantle cell, Chris. And you were telling me that you saw some patients on the CAR T floor that had gotten teclistamab, the bispecific for myeloma. Globally, can you talk a little bit about the level of CRS that you see, particularly with these in diffuse large B-cell? And the big question that all the oncologists are asking me, are they going to be given it?
Yeah, great. great questions. I think Lori touched upon the key points is that in general, the CRS, when we look at the incidence of the rates of that, it's highest in the first cycle of therapy. So by and large, this is something that you see typically with the earliest cycles. There have been a couple ways of being able to mitigate that. One is the step-up dosing with glofitamab. It's preceding dosing with obinutuzumab as a way to be able to take up some of that CD20 and to be able to mitigate that. And then the other thing that we've seen in some of the agents is the subcutaneous dosing that's helped to be able to reduce that risk. But by and large, this is a cycle one phenomenon that we see in terms of CRS, as well as the neurological toxicity ICANS. And as Lori said, I think the results in terms of the efficacy look to be quite promising. And so really looking forward to seeing how these agents proceed forward.
Yeah, I know it was myeloma, but I remember the day in October when teclistamab was approved, and I was like, wow, things are going to be different in oncology, not just myeloma. So I'm wondering a year from now how many bispecifics are going to be given in the community. All right, let's talk a little bit about Hodgkin. And Lori, we saw finally, after a long follow-up with the Echelon 1 study, the addition of brentuximab, finally, in the New England Journal this year, also published the survival benefit, the much looked after. You know, when the trial first came out, I think there was a lot of skepticism. A lot of people weren't, you know, using it. And I think the community was using it more than investigators. But also it was the control arm in the next randomized study. So that kind of told me what they were expecting. Any thoughts about this in the first line situation, Lori? Now we have a pretty decent survival benefit as well as progression-free survival. And I guess this is the progression-free that Chris showed with a hazard rate of 0.67 and even a better 0.59 hazard rate for survival. Any thoughts about this, Lori? Is this your first-line therapy, or are you able to give it in Canada?
Yeah, so, you know, this trial was performed in patients with stage 3 and 4 disease, and I think there was relatively slow uptake, maybe because at the beginning there was what was described as a modified progression-free survival benefit, although eventually a true PFS benefit was also declared. But now we saw an overall survival benefit emerge, and that, you know, clearly I think cements this as a current standard of care for appropriate patients. So here in Canada, it's interesting. We have relegated approval to use it in stage 4 patients. So I have been using this routinely for my stage 4 patients. At first, you know, the data seemed a little bit more modest in the stage 3 patients. So I think we're waiting to hopefully see funding there as well, especially in light of the overall survival data that's emerged with time. But nonetheless, I think it has become the current standard of care. There is, you know, undoubtedly in my mind, a step up in toxicity with the BV-AVD, and that, you know, there is more neutropenia. I think definitely more neuropathy seen, and it is harder to give than ABVD. So I think there's some patients where, you know, it doesn't stop me from using it, but I've had to sometimes, you know, go back to ABVD rather than BV-AVD if patients really run into trouble. But I think it is compelling now that we've got overall survival benefit until we see the next line of trials and whether or not checkpoint inhibitors move into the frontline setting. This, to me, has become the standard of care, you know, as long as there's no contraindication for patients in stage 3 and 4 disease.
So, Chris, you also talked about trials looking at it in earlier stage disease, including this study from the JCO last year. Any comments about that strategy, earlier stage?
Yeah, these were really provocative data looking at BV-AVD in terms of how it compared to ABVD in its PET negativity rate and 2-year progression-free survival in the early stage. I think, you know, the data are still reasonably immature, but I think it shows provocative data that it might also provide an advantage in that setting.
So it seems like we can never stop talking about antibody-drug conjugate, but this is actually a monoclonal antibody. I call it CAMI or camidanlumab tesirine. Chris, you reviewed that. Interesting agent in relapsed Hodgkin lymphoma. seems to have a good response rate, but also some interesting tolerability issues. Any comments about this agent and where you see it heading, Chris?
Yeah, it's exciting to see yet another agent that's approved in the relapse setting for Hodgkin lymphoma. You know, we talked up front about the BV-AVD regimen that is now, you know, curing a high fraction of patients with Hodgkin lymphoma. And so the vast majority of patients are cured in the upfront setting. But I think the challenge is that when patients are not cured in the upfront setting, you know, there are relatively few options that are curative. Auto transplants cures a minority of additional patients. But for many other patients, these are young patients that will need multiple different regimens and multiple lines of therapy, given that, you know, they're getting diagnosed in their 20s and 30s. And so now to have the potential of having yet another agent after the PD-1 inhibitors as other options for patients is intriguing. I think when you look at the toxicity of this agent, there are some unusual toxicities that we're seeing in here, the autoimmune related abnormalities that you also see with PD-1 inhibitors, as well as Guillain-Barré syndrome that was seen with camidamlimab. And so I think, you know, we'll need to see additional follow-up on this agent, but it is nice to see other potential options for the armamentarium for Hodgkin lymphoma.
So again, this is actually an ADC, not a monoclonal antibody. Any comments on this agent, Laurie?
So we did participate in at least one of the clinical trials investigating this agent, so I had some capacity to use it. Yeah, I think that it is terrible when you get to the end of line of options for patients with Hodgkin lymphoma. The reality is most patients do well. This is a curative disease, but, you know, inevitably we see these patients that once they fail PD-1 inhibition and don't have other curative options, you know, I'm at a loss for what to do. And this drug has shown very encouraging efficacy. And we had several patients on the trial here who managed to stay on it for quite some time. But it does have some intriguing toxicities. Skin toxicity has been one major concern in the patients I've managed. And I've had to bring on board a dermatologist to help me manage patients through this agent. But, you know, hopefully I think it's a learning curve and I'm encouraged by the efficacy. We'll have to see, as Chris says, more data and probably longer follow-up as well.
So let's talk about follicular lymphoma. There are a whole bunch of papers that Laurie reviewed in her talk. I'm not going to talk a lot about the gallium study. She talks about it and did the study, obinutuzumab versus rituximab. I think a lot of people still landing on rituximab, mainly for tolerability advantages, although a little bit of a benefit. Also, updating of the relevance trial, the R-squared regimen that we saw in the JCO this year, continuing to show, you know, approximate equivalence in the upfront setting to BR. But I want to ask you about tazemetostat. I'm going to start with you, Chris. As an interesting targeted agent, yet seems to benefit most patients either way. Can you comment on what your experience is with the drug? And in what situation do you use it, and to what extent do you look at biomarkers in making that decision?
Yeah, so I'll start with the last question. I think that's a difficult one for follicular lymphoma. I think, you know, when we think about genetic testing that we do in solid tumors and other settings, that's something that's been much less commonly used in the lymphomas. And we know that tazemetostat as an EGH2 inhibitor actually has at least better response rates in the patient population that has EZH2 mutations. The progression-free survival seems to be relatively similar for the two groups, and that's what's shown here, both for the mutant group and the wild-type group. But I think importantly, we do also see responses in the EZH2 wild-type group as well. So I think this is an agent in relapsed and refractory follicular lymphoma that can be used for the entire population. But I think if we were to move towards more universal EZH2 testing, at least, it would give us some ideas for which patients are more likely to be responders. I think the availability of that testing has not been quite as wide in the community or in academic practices as we would like.
Laurie, any comments about this agent, also tolerability profile?
Yeah, no, so I think it's a very well-tolerated drug that's easy to administer, and that's its primary attractiveness. You know, I think of it as a modestly active drug, as Chris said, you know, more active in patients who have EZH2 mutations, which is less than 15% of the follicular lymphoma population, but some benefit shown in both. I think this slide that you have on here is kind of interesting because, you know, the initial phase two trial really looked at two groups, those with mutations and those without, but they probably weren't comparable, that the patients without mutations had higher risk, more pretreatment. And when they did this propensity score matched analysis, I think less of a difference emerged between those two groups in benefits, certainly in terms of progression-free survival. So it, I would consider it, but, you know, I probably weigh it against the other options I have based on what I perceive the efficacy would be.
So one of the options you have now, as very, very recently, is going to be mosunetuzumab. Chris, I'll start out with you. Laurie reviewed the data, so exciting on this bispecific in her talk. Can you comment on your experience with this agent? But again, both in terms of tolerability and efficacy, seems like it's very effective.
Yeah, it's great to see these data out and to see these data really impacting practice. At this point, you know, this was a nice presentation and eventual publication of the mosunetuzumab data that shows very high overall response rates in the relapsed setting for patients with follicular lymphoma, as well as high CR rates. And these show kind of the comparison of the duration of complete response and PFS in comparison to their prior therapy. We also had a paper that came out at the tail end of last year by Carla Casullo, looking at real-world evidence for patients with third-line follicular lymphoma, and we'll have a future comparison that looks at a matched analysis in comparison to the kinds of patients that were on this trial. And what you see is that the response rates for this agent look to be quite similar and superior to even chemoimmunotherapy in this setting.
So, Laurie, any thoughts about this? You know, it'd be great to see a first-line trial, but actually I'm thinking a little bit about second-line, you know, in terms of would you want to give it before, you know, common second-line therapies are R-squared, you know, whether it's going to be more effective in the short or long run, I don't know. But the thing I was wondering about is what the tolerability would be in the long run. You know, obviously you'd have to deal with CRS in the beginning, but on the other hand, R-squared with lenalidomide is not always a walk in the park either. And maybe you can talk a little bit about tolerability profiles. It's hard for us out here to kind of even compare, say, tolerability of mosunetuzumab and FL to, let's say, glofitamab and diffuse large B-cell. It kind of sounds like maybe it's better tolerated. Mm-hmm. But what's your experience with it, and where would you like to use it?
Yeah. So if we look at the treatment landscape for follicular lymphoma right now, I would say that frontline is still sort of secured by chemoimmunotherapy and very often maintenance anti-CD20 antibody after that. I'd say R-squared has pretty much become a preferred second-line treatment in this disease. And then, you know, third-line and beyond is, it's really open-ended. You know, we have CAR T-cell therapy available for some patients, but there's no standard of care in the third-line. And I think that the emergence of mosunetuzumab is going to, it's currently approved for the third line setting and beyond. And I think it's going to be firmly ingrained right now as the third line preferred treatment. Because in my experience, and we did participate in the mosunetuzumab trial, it is very well tolerated by patients. So beyond the first cycle, where we have the requirement again for the step up dosing to monitor for CRS, this is, you know, a treatment that I'd say patients really have done very well on in terms of minimal toxicity. Like most of my patients feel like it's similar to being on single agent rituximab once they get, you know, beyond that first cycle and the monitoring that's required. There's probably a little bit more neutropenia with this agent that needs to be monitored for, but at least from the patient's perception, you know, there's really minimal side effects, and I think their quality of life is excellent. This, of course, is going to be tested in earlier lines of therapy. There are many trials going on trying to combine it with combinations like R-squared and even chemoimmunotherapy or other novel therapies, and all that data needs to evolve, and we'll see. But, you know, I really think that this will become a very preferred third line treatment at this point. And, you know, maybe a desirable option for some patients who are not suitable for some of our earlier lines of treatment as well. So I think it's a really quickly evolving landscape. It'll be nice to get these drugs out into the mainstream. But, you know, it is hopefully something that community doctors will inevitably be able to give. The CRS that was seen was largely low grade. There's not going to be a requirement for mandated hospitalization with this. So I think it will be hopefully deliverable out in the community.
So you just answered like three or four questions from the chat room. Hey, I want to get to mantle cell and make sure we have enough time there. Anything you want to add to that? And Chris, as in diffuse large B cell, there's a bunch of other bispecifics. A lot of them are the same that we just talked about. Odronextamab is one. From my point of view, it's kind of hard to differentiate these. This is sub-Q EPCO. You know, that's interesting, the fact that it's sub-Q. This is a combination with R-squared, but epcoritamab is another very exciting agent. We were talking about tazemetostat before. Tazemetostat's being combined with R-squared. It seems like everything gets combined as you move up earlier, but we'll see whether these play out in phase 3 trials. And then, of course, we have the issue of CAR T therapy and the use of axi-cel in these patients. Chris, any comments on these other bispecifics and also CAR T when you were making rounds? Did you have any follicular patients there on the floor?
Yeah, so we did have follicular patients who were getting CAR T following these data from Zuma 5. And this is also another attractive agent or approach for patients where you see, meaningful progression-free survival and very high response rates for follicular population. I think the challenge here is identifying who is the right follicular lymphoma patient to proceed ahead with CAR-T. These tend to be younger patients, tend to be fitter patients, and patients who've had more aggressive behaving disease, typically early relapse of disease with their follicular lymphoma.
All right, mantle cell lymphoma. Let's see if you can at least straighten me out about this, because I came out of ASH thinking, whoa, that's interesting. So, of course, at ASCO, we saw the SHINE study combining ibrutinib with BR, and then one of the plenary talks at the ASH meeting, the TRIANGLE study from the European Mantle Cell Consortium, adding ibrutinib in younger patients going for transplant. Also, we talked a little bit about the triplet, again, R-squared, but with the BTK inhibitor, acalabrutinib. We'll go through some of those data. Triplet with venetoclax, rituximab, acalabrutinib. And then, of course, CAR-T approved as well. And finally, zanubrutinib. So the main thing I want to figure out is the first-line stuff to start with. So, Chris, we saw the SHINE data. It added in ibrutinib, and you saw a modest benefit in terms of PFS, hazard rate around, I think, 0.75. Yeah, 0.75. Didn't seem like people are too excited about it. And then, also the issue of tolerability. We're going to talk about this tomorrow night, what happens when you combine, because we don't know that from CLL, because you don't use chemo in CLL. But here you're combining BTK, which already has its issues, now with chemotherapy. I'm curious about your thoughts about that. But it kind of looked like in this situation, it sort of did better, there was more excitement about it, particularly about the issue of whether you can bypass transplant. So I know that's a lot. I just wanted to get it out there, and then we can just sort of talk about it. So Chris, first-line therapy mantle cell and bringing in BTK, what do these two trials tell you?
Yeah, so when you look at the SHINE data, you know, we're typically thinking about bendamustine, rituximab, sometimes in older patients with mantle cell lymphoma, or patients where you are not using the aggressive approach that we'll talk about next in the TRIANGLE study. You know, clearly this shows that there is a pre-FS benefit for the addition of ibrutinib to BR. And this was another New England Journal of Medicine paper by my colleague Michael Wong. I think the trade-offs there, though, are the toxicity that we see with the addition of ibrutinib. And I think still a little bit of an open question is, yes, there is a PFS benefit if you add the ibrutinib up front, but what if you use BR as your upfront therapy, and then when a patient relapses, give ibrutinib after that, which is a sequential approach to mantle cell lymphoma, where in older patients, where you're not thinking about a long durable remission in the first line as your main focus of therapy, but rather tolerable therapies, which could be an approach with less toxicity that could be used. And so I think it doesn't really answer that question. And so I think consequently, it has not have a major change in terms of the ways that patients are treated currently. In terms of the, go ahead.
I was just going to, before you go into the next one, just get Laurie's take on it. You know, there's a classic question in oncology. Do you give everything up front or, you know, do you give it sequentially? You know, I think if we had like osimertinib, like hazard rate of, you know, 0.2 or something, then maybe there'd be a different discussion here. But 0.75 is a lot more modest. What was your take on this, Laurie?
Yeah, I would fully agree with Chris. I mean, this is a classic example of needing to weigh in the risk and the benefit. So mantle cell lymphoma is still not curable with our available options. And, you know, this trial showed us that you can get a better progression-free survival with the addition of the ibrutinib here, but there was a trade-off, and that was a trade-off of higher toxicity. So in the end, the overall survival was not different because there were an excess number of deaths related to treatment toxicities in the group receiving the ibrutinib. So I have to say that this has not persuaded me to give triple therapy in my own patient population, and I would still use these agents sequentially at this point in time because of the lack of the overall survival benefit here of moving it forward and the real concern for toxicity, at least with ibrutinib.
So where the potential practice change come in? I'm still waiting for the myeloma people to get rid of a transplant, but we'll see about that. But, you know, question is, can we, here's the survival data that you just mentioned. So the question is, can you get rid of transplant by adding in an upfront BTK inhibitor? Chris, based on this trial, it kind of looks like the answer is yes. Is that your answer?
Yeah, so I think this was really a provocative trial. It was presented by Martin Dreiling at the ASH meeting as the first plenary abstracts are really viewed to be the top impacting abstract of the meeting. I was fortunate enough to be the introducer for Martin for this presentation. And it starts with the question, with the control arm of giving R-CHOP alternating with R-DAP followed by autologous transplant. That's based on the older European mantle cell consortium data that showed that that was a superior offered a superior PFS for patients with mantle cell lymphoma. And then asked the question is, if you add ibrutinib to the R-CHOP portion of that and then give ibrutinib maintenance after the transplant, is that better than the transplant alone? And then asked the next question, if you add ibrutinib and give 2 years of ibrutinib maintenance without a transplant, how does that compare to each of those other two arms? And I think the question has still not yet been answered about avoiding the transplant, but if you look at the early evidence from the survival curves, it does not look like the autologous transplant is going to compare favorably to no transplant with ibrutinib in terms of the tested hypothesis that that arm with transplant was going to be superior to ibrutinib alone. And so I think this is really starting to raise questions about whether there's a value to doing a transplant in the upfront setting for younger fit patients with mantle cell.
And then, you know, as happened in CLL, are we going to use a second generation BTK to take this, you know, concept and apply it to acalabrutinib or zanabrutinib? Laurie, what was your take on this? Are you ready to give let transplant go the way? I mean, I don't even know that there was that great of data for transplant, you know, randomized data for transplant anyhow to start with. But anyhow, what are you thinking, Laurie?
You know, so as Chris mentioned, this was number one on the abstracts at ASH this year. So, you know, you get to be number one because everybody perceives it to be potentially game-changing and practice-changing data. I was kind of surprised based on my discussions with colleagues after the presentation that not too many seem to be willing to let go of that transplant at this point in time. It is a complicated trial design, a complicated statistical analysis, but in the end, if you look at those curves, it's hard to argue that, you know, the curves with ibrutinib did favorable against the transplant curve. No hint that there's going to be an overall survival benefit by leaving that transplant in if you bring in the BTK inhibitor. So I think it does tell me that I need to rethink whether or not I need a transplant in all of my patients. So, you know, if you roll in a BTK inhibitor earlier, you may be able to let go of the transplant, but I don't know that people are there yet in agreement. And then I think we do need to see this data presented in more detail. Only about half of the patients received rituximab maintenance. You know, does that somehow affect the result that we're seeing? I think we need to see this sort of looked at more closely.
So I just have to say, I'm completely confused between these two trials, like what it ultimately really means. And I'm sure we're going to be talking about it endlessly over the next year. Chris, any thought?
Yeah, I suspect that, you know, it may not matter what oncologists think about these data. This might be data that once the paper's published, that patients will vote with their feet, and they may choose not to get a transplant if there's an option not to get a transplant and have similar outcomes by giving ibrutinib in the upfront setting.
So I wonder if a non-chemo strategy in the long run is going to be better than any of these things anyhow, Laurie. One of the things that you talked about in your talk was this fascinating concept of BTK and R-squared together. Here they used MRD. Any thoughts about this kind of strategy?
Well, you know, so the same group of authors had presented some data on R-squared alone in the upfront setting for mantle cell lymphoma, showing that it can have actually some prolonged benefit in patients. But in my own clinic, I'm not particularly using R-squared very often upfront. But, you know, intriguingly here in this trial, they added a acalabrutinib to that and saw very, very high response rate and the intention to treat 24 patients that they presented of 100% and a very high CR rate. This was an interesting trial design. They actually factored in MRD partway through, and for patients who are MRD negative at a certain time point, I think it was 24 months, they actually stopped the treatment and patients maintained benefit. So I like this trial for two reasons, that it did combine an effective agent to, you know, create a triple therapy of a non-chemotherapy-based approach. They've shown high response rates, impressive durability, and a nice use of MRD to potentially give us a more finite type of therapy. But it's a small number of patients. It's a single-arm study. And, you know, I think we need to see this, see more data and see this compared against other options.
So before I ask Chris, so here's another non-chemo triplet and untreated, makes a lot of sense. A BTK and venetoclax, you're getting talked a lot about with CLL plus rituximab, also very encouraging data. Also, we saw more follow-up data on the use of CAR-T in mantle cell, really a standard option now. I think people start thinking about after BTK. Chris, any thoughts about these triplets and about CAR-T over this past year?
Yeah, so CAR-T really has moved to the standard armamentarium for patients with relapsed mantle cell lymphoma. I think it's still predominantly used at specialized centers that are focused on CAR-T. The triplet combination that you mentioned also is quite intriguing, particularly as we start to move it earlier in lines of therapy. And then I think the most intriguing, going back to the very beginning of our conversation, is where pirtobrutinib will fit into that. And will we start to see pirtobrutinib being linked into triplets like pirtobrutinib, venetoclax, rituximab, or doublets like pirtobrutinib, rituximab?
Can you imagine being a general medical oncologist? I mean, this is like a tiny part of general medical oncology. They got all these other things. Anyhow, Chris and Laurie, thank you so much for working with us tonight. Audience, thank you for attending. I want to hear more about BTK, pirtobrutinib, and everything else coming back tomorrow night. We'll talk about toxicity with these agents. Be safe, stay well, and have a great night. Thanks so much, Laurie. Thanks, Chris.
Thank you.